How can we be more bold, more ambitious? This is an incredible moment, and we won't get a lot of these. And so how do we make the most of it so that our members can have better lives and we can have a long-term voice of power in this country?
Hi, and welcome to the Practical Radicals podcast. I'm Deepak Bhargava.
And I'm Stephanie Luce. Today on our show, we will be talking about Minnesota, where some incredibly exciting organizing is going on. About 15 years ago, a group of practical radicals from unions and community organizations began working together to figure out how to shift politics in the state. Since then, they've employed almost all of the 7 strategies we cover in the book, and they've won huge victories, including major legislative wins last year. Now, 10 unions and community organizations are building towards a possible general strike in the first week of March. How did they get here? All of this began with the fundamentals of solidarity power and base building, and that's the theme of today's show.
Our book is called Practical Radicals, 7 Strategies to Change the World. And this week, we'll actually start talking about the 7 strategies. Last episode, we focused on forms of power, and we said that the kinds of power you have access to will be relevant for the kinds of strategies you can employ. In Practical Radicals, we offer 7 strategies for change, which we call base building, disruptive movements, narrative shift, electoral change, inside-outside campaigns, momentum, and collective care.
In the coming episodes, we'll dig into each strategy one by one and then come back to talking about how they can work together. The first strategy on our list is base building, and it's so important that we've decided to cover it in 2 episodes. First, we're focusing on the labor movement and the exciting news out of Minnesota. And in our next episode, we'll look at base building from a community organizing perspective, highlighting the amazing victories won by Make the Road New York. Today, we'll say a bit about the strategy of base building overall, and then we'll talk with Greg Nomaker, president of SEIU Local 26, about how base building is the foundation of union power.
The essence of the base building model is building lasting power through organization. The heart of the model is solidarity power, the power that comes when underdogs unite as community members, as workers, as tenants. It's the power of numbers. The theory of change is that lots of people acting in solidarity with discipline and for the long term can pressure corporations or landlords or other institutions to win major victories. We argue that base building using solidarity power is the most fundamental model for transformative change because many of the other models depend on base building as a key element.
Base building might also be the strategy model that most underdogs are familiar with, since millions of Americans belong to labor unions and community organizations. And base building is essential for environmental, tenant, and faith-based groups as well. Groups differ a lot, but almost all of them need to recruit and engage members. Solidarity power is partly about numbers, but it's also about what membership means and the role member leaders play. It's vital to cultivate members who are committed to the organization and to each other and willing to pour their hearts into campaigns.
Whatever interest I had was primarily for people who were living in given situations to realize that there was a strength they had within them. And by combined efforts, they could do something about whatever their conditions were that they wanted to see changed.
That's legendary organizer Ella Baker from a documentary we'll link to in the show notes called Fundi, The Story of Ella Baker. Fundi is a Swahili word for a person in a community who masters a craft. And if there ever was a master of the craft of base building, it was Baker. In the 1940s, years before the civil rights movement captivated the nation's attention, Ella Baker spent half of each year crisscrossing the South as field secretary and director of branches for the NAACP. Here's another clip from the documentary that attests to her amazing dedication.
Her schedule for a week in Georgia in 1942 reads, Thursday, Savannah. Friday, Macon. Sunday, Columbus. Monday, Savannah Mass Meeting. Tuesday, Brunswick Mass Meeting. Wednesday, Waycross Branch Meeting. Thursday, Augusta mass meeting. Friday, Athens.
Baker called the patient, unglamorous labor of organizing spade work, comparing it to digging ditches or gardening. She used that term spade work often, and I love it. Spade work is something we could use a lot more of in our time when many seem to judge their effectiveness in the number of likes or retweets they get on social media.
Whenever I'm feeling burnt out, Baker's idea of spade work reminds me of the importance of that day-to-day personal relationship building. It's crucial, not just because it's necessary for power, but it's really, at the end of the day, what we're all about, which is fostering human connection and community with one another.
Right, and movements are built out of the relationships developed through organizing. One of my favorite books about organizing is Charles Payne's I've Got the Light of Freedom, A History of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. Payne writes about the relationship of civil rights movement organizers and local leaders. We often focus on media flashpoints like mass marches, but movements are built out of slower, patient work. Payne writes, "Our collective imagery of the movement does not include George Green returning to talk to some frightened farmer for the 10th time, or Mary Lane taking the registration test 11 times before she's allowed to pass, or Ivanhoe Donaldson and Charles Cobb returning at night to a town they were run out of that day. Overemphasizing the movement's more dramatic features, we undervalue the patient and sustained effort, the slow, respectful work that made the dramatic moments possible."
The strongest groups work to train members as leaders and invite them to take ownership of an organization. Ella Baker was famous for saying that we don't need charismatic leaders to make change, that everyday people have the capacity to change the world.
Base building, bringing those everyday people together, is a strategy for all times. But it's taken many forms, including organizations like SNCC and the Civil Rights Movement, and community organizations and labor unions. While unions use a variety of strategies, at their heart, they're about bringing together coworkers to engage in collective action. And that means their strength lies in the ability to unite around common demands, which isn't as easy as it might sound. We'll hear more about this in just a bit when we speak with Greg Nomaker. Lots of workplaces are quite diverse in terms of race, gender, language, and even the kinds of work that people do. So unions need to do the work to help people see that they are stronger together than they are apart.
Unions are also up against powerful overdogs. U.S. labor laws have always privileged employers, and employers are able to violate all kinds of laws with impunity. State and federal officials have also been known to side with employers to infiltrate unions, break up strikes, and even kill unionists. Here's how the documentary Golden Lands, Working Hands describes the Great Strike at the dawn of industrial organizing in the U.S.
In July of 1877, hundreds of thousands of railroad workers around the country go on strike, protesting wage cuts below subsistence level. A war breaks out. On one side, the railroads, assisted by police and National Guard. On the other, railroad workers, their families and communities, fed up with the power and arrogance of the railroad companies. Hundreds of workers are killed.
A.J. Musty, a 20th century labor organizer, wrote about how unions face an inherent tension. They have to find a balance between serving as a democratic town hall where members hash out ideas and issues together, and at times needing to be like an army, which is a much more hierarchical institution. So this means that on the one hand, a union has to be a democratic space for workers to debate, but union members at times have to act with a lot of discipline when they're fighting the boss. They have to stick together and they have to follow leadership in order to be effective. And sometimes just sticking together and acting with discipline isn't enough to win. Today, many workers are employed by massive global corporations. They might work for subcontractors or via temp agencies, but the ultimate employer calling the shots is a corporate behemoth that has the resources to outlast a strike. Corporations also hire union-busting consultants and lawyers who employ a variety of tactics to prevent workers from unionizing in the first place or to break existing unions. In these cases, base building might not be enough on its own. unions may need additional strategies, and they may need to build other forms of power.
One way that unions are building new alliances and more power is through a framework called bargaining for the common good. This is the idea that unions can work with community organizations and other stakeholders to build partnerships around a long-term vision. They can use union bargaining power as a tool to win structural changes needed to move towards the world as it should be. In the book, we write about how the St. Paul Federation of Educators adopted this approach as a way to win gains that benefit students and parents as well as teachers, and engaged many teachers in the union who hadn't been active before.
To explore these issues, Stephanie spoke with Greg Nomaker, president of SEIU Local 26 in Minneapolis-St. Paul. SEIU stands for the Service Employees International Union, one of the country's biggest unions that represents workers in a whole variety of sectors, including government, healthcare, home care, janitorial and building services. Local 26 has been digging into the base building model for decades, and that has enabled them to adopt other strategies along the way.
Welcome to the show, Greg.
Hey, welcome, Stephanie.
So can you start off by just explaining to our listeners what your union does, who you represent, the kinds of work that members do?
Sure. So SEIU Local 26 is a union of about 8,000 property service workers in the 7-county metro area of the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And, you know, that means we represent janitors, security officers, airport workers, the folks who push the wheelchairs in the airport, and big box retail store cleaners as well.
Great. And I've known you for a long time. I know when you first got involved in the labor movement, unions were really on the decline. Union membership was down, and it felt like people were saying, this is over. This is the end of the labor movement. And you came in to SEIU with a real vision of rebuilding the union, along with many others. You were part of a powerful team. So can you talk a bit about what things were like when you got there and what you all have been doing to rebuild the power of the union?
Yeah. Well, and as you say, this was really the work of a team of folks. You know, I just have been so privileged to work with some incredible organizers and people just so passionate about helping their coworkers to win a better life. So, but as a group, you know, I arrived at Local 26 about 16 years ago. And the first work that we really realized we had to do was internal. At that time, the leadership of the union was primarily white. It at that time represented just about 4,000 workers. And the majority of the workforce was Spanish-speaking. And there was really a huge disconnect between the leadership of the union and the vast majority of the rank and file. So the first work was really internal and creating a more participatory union. I was actually hired on by Javier Morillo, who had just become the president at that time and really wanted to open up a new chapter in the locals' life. So, you know, the first work was we worked together to hire staff and to work with developing the leadership of rank and file members to become the next level of elected leadership that really reflected the membership and their languages. So we went from zero Spanish speakers on staff to the majority Spanish speaking and bilingual, brought on some Somali speaking staff as well. We created caucuses by language that were able to identify issues that were really important to different segments of the membership so that they could see their union working on those issues, which was incredibly important for our local because, you know, on the janitorial side, we were probably about 30% East African, about 60% Latinx, and on the security side, about 50% African American and US born white. You know, it was a very diverse membership, and really making sure that folks saw themselves reflected in their own union was a key first step to getting people to step forward and take the risks that we know have to happen if you're going to change the power dynamics in your own worksite. You know, another just simple piece was building the infrastructure. We had to buy the translation equipment to make sure that all of our meetings could become bilingual or even trilingual. In fact, now it's not uncommon to have 5 languages translated at our general membership meetings and board meetings. So another piece was just at the kind of internal democracy level. We changed the monthly membership meetings from 5 p.m. on Mondays, which if you think about a union that's majority janitors, that's the time when most folks work second shift. So it meant that very few people participated in the democratic life of decision-making in the union. So we moved that to Saturdays at 11 a.m. and, you know, brought food and the translation to those meetings. And suddenly we had large participatory meetings with, you know, hundreds or more folks. Then we also decided to move a new constitution, which would change the kind of structure of decision making. And so we now have a leadership assembly once a year where stewards actually vote on the entire budget and the plan of the union for a year. So that's a large participatory process that takes many months of input leading up to that. And that was very different from the very closed small decision making that had been the practice in the constitution earlier. And then finally, we did some changes in our dues structure to actually increase resources. Now, of course, that was difficult, but that was a part of the work with people seeing that the union was going to be a fighting organization. They were prepared to put more money in because it's true. If you're picking big fights with the most powerful corporations in your community, you need the resources to be able to sustain those fights. So those were really the first internal steps. Then the second piece was really understanding that without militant action against the companies, there was no way we could fundamentally change the living standards of our members and their experience at work. And that meant in part, and this was an extremely important part back then, this was, 16, 20 years ago, was sort of re-embracing the power of strikes. Now, we know in the 80s and 90s, very few unions were doing strikes. Folks felt, I think in general, that it was a dangerous tool that put workers in a very vulnerable position. And obviously with a very united political and large corporate class, it was very difficult to win strikes in those circumstances. But that said, we really believed this was going to be key, and showing worker militancy was necessary if we were going to make a breakthrough and go a different direction with our union. So in the 70s, most janitors worked directly for the building owners. Many of them had pensions, they had health insurance, these were good jobs. So subcontracting hit our market very hard. We did lose the union in many cities around the country. In Minneapolis, we almost lost the union, but we did lose all the substance of what we had negotiated over the previous, 60 years. And so as a result, most janitors worked for subcontractors. It was almost entirely part-time work. Very few people had health insurance. If they did, it was employer-controlled health insurance that, tended to have huge co-premiums. And these were basically minimum wage jobs, even those that had a union. So we decided that we were going to really focus with the members on raising expectations, not lowering expectations. I think especially at that time in the labor movement, many union leaders were trying to be truthful with their membership and to sort of keep expectations of being able to win too much down, right? Just so that folks weren't disappointed when they didn't win things at the bargaining table, and truthfully so that the leadership didn't get blamed. But our belief was really the opposite, that we needed to raise expectations, that if workers were going to be willing to fight, which was clearly needed if we were going to change these power dynamics in the industry, that people had to be ready to risk and put things on the line. And that was only going to happen if we had big demands that really meant huge structural changes. So we expanded the bargaining committee. We now have what we call open bargaining, which can have as many as 150 janitors coming to any one bargaining session. But most importantly, it was open to any janitor. So folks started to come and they started to see with their own eyes, oh, this is how the employers are treating us, right? We've never been invited into this space. And it felt really empowering for them. We also put together our economic demands, full-time work, union-controlled health insurance, increasing the wages significantly. But we also did some specific demands that kind of get back to this question of how did we get people to participate, especially when we didn't have a culture of a participating union before that. And so with these different language groups, I'd said that there was a set of Spanish speakers that started to really kind of be a center of gravity, and a set of Somali speakers. And so out of those language groups, there came very different demands. Now, I think some unions at the time really were of the perspective, look, we need to limit the things we fight over to the things that everybody agrees on. Everybody agrees we want a wage raise, so let's just stay focused on that. Everything else is a distraction that might divide us. So we rejected that. We thought that was completely wrong, as well as led you to a union that was very narrow and brittle. And so we said, we want to hear from our Somali-speaking brothers and sisters that traditionally had not been at all in the life of the union, even more marginalized than the Latino membership. And ask them, in addition to the wages and health benefits, what are the other things that particularly come in from your experience that you're looking for? And so they raised things like, well, we want to have leave of absence that can be 3 months, even if it's unpaid, because it takes us so much time to get back to our home country to visit our parents and get back that with our normal vacation amounts, we can't do it. So we wanted to have paid or unpaid 3 month leaves. They said we also wanted to have obviously more protections around wearing hijab, wearing various clothing that was religiously and culturally appropriate. That right at that point, we didn't have any language in. So that was important to them. Now, many of the Latino membership did not understand and were frankly opposed to some of those proposals, based on just their own experiences and dynamics and tensions within some of these communities more broadly. And the Latino membership actually brought up a set of issues around ICE audits. Now, most East Africans in the Twin Cities, not all, but most, were here with legal documentation. Many of the Latino migrants who had come had been prevented from getting that kind of documentation. And so having protections against ICE audits that were random and done without any input from workers and any sense of fair steps was an important demand for those workers. Now, frankly, many of the East African workers didn't understand those demands or think that those were particularly important to them. But what we did is in these large bargaining committee meetings, we created the space where people could negotiate that out, where people could talk about their different needs, and where we started to try and create a perspective of, if I respect my fellow co-workers' demands, even if they're different than mine, then they will respect and support my demands, even if they don't share them. We use the same framework to deal with holidays later in bargaining sessions in the future, right? Where different holidays were important to different groups, but by the groups supporting each other's holidays, they had a much better shot at winning their own. And so creating those kind of raised expectations, having not only general demands, but also demands that were important to each specific constituency, we were able to get to a point that we had previously not been able to do, which is to take a strike vote. It had been literally 60 years since anybody could remember a strike vote at Local 26. And we did strike votes basically in every single contract expiration from that point forward. You know, since then, we've been on strike maybe 10 times in the last 10 years. And that has become an important muscle in our union, which I think was absolutely critical in changing our power dynamics with the employers and really starting to win some major breakthroughs. So those were some of the first pieces that we really came to our local thinking about, that internal work first, then that reusing the strike as a tool and all the building and the bridge building within the union around demands and raising expectations that were needed to do that. And that really then brought us to a different question, which was, how could we build power more broadly in the community as we took on bigger demands? Would we have the power to win those if we were just well organized within our particular sector? And that started to push us to think outside of the union for the first time.
That's great. So I want to dig in a bit more on this internal rebuilding, because a lot of people in unions, union staff, union leaders start out by saying, well, that sounds good for you, but no one really cares. People are really too busy. They work multiple hours. They have childcare. And you have listed a number of things that you did in terms of the language caucuses and changing the times of the meeting. So those all sound great. But could you just say a bit more on how you respond when people say, people don't care, people don't have the time? How do you get them to engage in the union?
I remember early on at Local 26, we were running into those same problems, right? How do we engage people? How do we bring them together? Everybody said they couldn't get together. They were too busy with two and three jobs, which that was completely true. Everybody did have all those jobs. Then there came a moment when the employer, this was very early in the Obama administration, where the employer came forward and said, we have been approached by ICE and there is an audit. And the next day we had a meeting in the middle of the day at 11 o'clock in the morning, and 600 members showed up. I mean, it was an extremely hard time, and there's a whole story about that moment, but it just really showed, if people understand what is at stake, then they will figure out a way to come. And our job as organizers and as leaders in our unions and as rank and file activists is we've got to really get into deep, real relationships with people around the issues that they care about. And if we are in touch with those things, then it is incredible the mountains that people will move to be able to participate and be a part of a path to win on the things they care about. But that does mean we have to have a credible path to win that people can really believe in, right? People don't sacrifice their time with their kids and with taking care of their parents if they don't really believe in the path that we're going. And they also don't participate at that level if what we're fighting for isn't big enough to make that sacrifice worth it. So, you know, what does that look like in day-to-day operation? I just think there's no shortcut for the slow, hard work of organizing, human to human, person to person. And, you know, that means visiting work sites. If you are at the staff level or the leader level, it means identifying who are the people in those work sites who are not the most vocal, right? I mean, how many times have I and others gone down the short path of whoever has got the biggest opinions when I walk into a space? You know, maybe they're the great activist, right? They sure are angry at the boss, but that is not necessarily the right leader, right? A leader is somebody who has the respect of their coworkers, who their coworkers follow, who when they speak, it may be, you know, with a quiet voice, but people shut up and listen, right? Those are the folks that we've got to build our union structure around. And again, another shortcoming that many staff have, especially early on, is people then think, okay, if I just have as a staff person, call more people and have more conversations, then I can personally get all these folks to turn out. But really, the only thing that works over and over again, and especially in a strike context where people have to take a step where they are risking a lot, is if they have a coworker in their worksite who they respect, that has got to be the person talking to them about the next step, not an outside staff person. Really looking for those leaders in the worksites is the most important work, and then building a real relationship with them, which often takes a long time. I often think when you walk into a worksite, the person who tells you off is very likely going to be the best leader in there, especially if the union legitimately hasn't been doing anything. And so, you know, really trying to be patient and building a real relationship means you got to show your relationship with them, right? If an issue comes up, show that you've got their back. That's not as a service, right? That's not as just delivering some, you know, righteous outcome that was previously impossible, but it's more having their back, being with them as they try and lead their coworkers into a place where they can start to win little fights. And often building off those little fights then builds confidence in where you're going as an overall union. And it's true too, sometimes we ask people to come to big meetings at the union hall, and that's not the right first ask, right? Many times it's doing things in their own worksite, building up that confidence that then leads them to a place where they can take bigger steps. It's interesting now at Local 26, our highest density of leadership to membership, right? So the most active set of folks are actually the folks who have the worst structural conditions for getting together in a union. Our retail janitors who clean big box stores. We're the only master contract of a geographic area in the country that has big box cleaning stores under one contract. So those janitors, they generally have at most two people that would work at their store, usually just themselves. And yet there's a higher number of them per capita, per member, participating in the union than any other. And that's been because of that careful, slow relational work. So, you know, one other piece is tapping into and trusting and doubling down on the social connections that people already have, both at work and outside of work. That's another key way to get people, I think, involved, given how busy the rest of their lives are. So, you know, we did some little things at the beginning, like we had a winter party where people brought food, trying to, you know, double down on just the fun elements of the union. We started in Minnesota, people traditionally in the European American communities have traditions of meat raffles. So we did a meat raffle, but with, you know, in the riff of Local 26. So we had camel meat was the, if you got the best number in the meat raffle, you got to pick camel meat. You know, things that would just connect with members and have the union be fun, as well as a serious way for them to have more power at work. More recently, you know, we've also been really trying to use WhatsApp as a social media tool. You know, again, social media does not replace the real one-to-one organizing, but once you've built those relationships, you know, we have found it's a great way, especially within different language groups, for people to connect and sort of be sharing both at a social level, but obviously at a serious organizing level, some of the work that they're doing. I mean, we've been experimenting a lot about WhatsApp that's structured across an entire sector, so like all retail janitors, and then also having leaders create their own WhatsApps in their own work sites as a way, especially in these very split up work sites that are very common now in many industries. WhatsApp does allow a single leader to have 10, 15 people that they may not see every day, but then they can be in contact with every day. So we're continuing to experiment with some of those tools. Again, never in place of the deep human relationships, but in addition, given how atomized the workplace is.
So you told us about the work you did to rebuild internally, and then you started looking externally, and then some of that went to looking beyond the union, looking at building alliances with other partners that could help you win bigger demands. And we shared a story in the book about how you all used a model called bargaining for the common good. And I'm wondering if you can start out by explaining that work to us and what is bargaining for the common good and how did you apply it?
As Local 26, I think how we started to think about this question is we had started to do these strike votes within the different sectors. First janitorial, we ended up going out on strike for a newly organized security unit and ended up doing five strikes for our retail big box cleaners. And part of what we started to realize was even now as a union that we were strong within a particular sector and that workers in that sector were ready to fight, you know, in property services, we are not at 100% density of the entire market. And so if you think about like a big building, like the IDS, which is one of our big downtown towers, you know, even when janitors are at 100% going out on strike from the IDS, that's 50 people. standing out in front of a massive 80-story steel and glass building. So it is not a knockout punch from an economic perspective by just having a strike of workers within that industry. So we started to ask ourselves, as we're asking for bigger demands, right, as we're starting to talk about things like more significant wage raises, training and upgrade funds, a pension, right, these are beyond what we can win just as a sector ourselves getting ready to go on strike. So the first step of that for us was, well, what about the other sectors within our union, right? What would it look like if the janitorial contracts expired at the same time as the security contracts, who actually are subcontractors in many cases at the same buildings? So starting to align our expiration dates across our contracts was one step. But we realized that even wasn't enough, that at the end of the day, some of the big building owners that really made the decisions about how much the market was willing to pay, of course, through contractors, right? We were at the bargaining table. Our contracts are signed, our checks are signed as workers by the contractors that we work for. But the contractors get their contracts with the building owners. So at the end of the day, the building owners were truly making the decisions about what direction the market would go in. And those building owners were not just making decisions about our contracts, they were making many of the big decisions about what was going on in our community in general. For example, U.S. Bank was a major bank in the Twin Cities. And at one point, you know, we started to really understand, well, U.S. Bank is not only a major building owner that has many contractors who we're negotiating with, U.S. Bank actually is also foreclosing on the janitor who cleans the CEO of U.S. Bank's actual physical office. Her name is Rosalina, and she was getting foreclosed on by U.S. Bank as she cleaned his office. But U.S. Bank was also foreclosing on tons of folks' homes in the city in general. This was back around 2009 during the housing crisis. And so we really started to realize if we're going to move U.S. Bank to be into a dialogue about how we could really raise standards for workers, we need to also be in relationship with the different other organizations that are advocating around housing, such as at that time, an organization called NOC, and figure out how do we come to the table together. Interestingly, in the U.S. Bank example, we also realized that many of our Somali members in the language caucus had been raising issues about sending remittances home to East Africa, and that after 9/11, the U.S. government had made it very difficult to actually send remittances home because of their pre-established prejudices around why people would be sending money, God forbid, to their grandma and grandpa in Somalia. So at that time, we decided to then put together a set of discussions with U.S. Bank that actually included folks who were in the process of losing their homes through NOC, folks through Local 26, where we were engaged in talking about issues around our contracts and fair pay and wages, and folks from the Somali community and a few key mosques trying to get U.S. Bank to open up a path to remittances and the kind of financial steps necessary to send money home. So that's it's an example of like what it looks like as we started to realize we needed more power than we could do in our own narrow sector. And so how could we start to build an architecture? The word that we used for it was an alignment rather than a coalition to really build that kind of power more broadly in our community. So for me, that's what bargaining for the common good means broadly, is how do we use our traditional union tools of negotiation, right, for a finite sector of workers. And rather than just thinking about that in the kind of bread and butter pay and wages and health insurance for our own directly represented members, how do we think about the act of bargaining as an opportunity to be in dialogue with some of the key decision makers in our communities and to bring more issues to the table than just the narrow ones that our employers want us to bring to the table? You know, these are from a technical level, these are not required issues to discuss, but they are not illegal to bring to the table. And that is why it's important that we start to think about that power of a union more broadly. You know, I think there are many unions around the country, as well as Local 26 before this orientation, where we participated in coalitions. Coalitions are a group of folks from different organizations coming together around one issue, maybe electing somebody, that's a type of coalition, maybe winning a specific policy demand like 15 as a minimum wage. Those are important. Those are coalitions. But the problem with a coalition is it comes together on that single issue. And then when that issue is won, when the election is won, or when the 15 policy is passed, then the coalition tends to fall apart. And so for us, what we realized is if we're going to be in a long-term relationship where it's not just going to be the janitors bargaining for their own contract, but the janitors and the security officers and the airport workers aligning their expirations at the same time as being in relationship with these other community organizations, if we're going to do that, we need to think differently. And so we called that an alignment. And in alignment, you're really investing in each other's organizations in the long run. You're thinking about not how can everybody jump on my issue. It's not how can everybody help Local 26 janitors win a fair contract and win a pension. But the question is, how do each of us have our own demands that our own memberships and our own organizations care about? And then how do we find who are the big decision makers in our community that many times are actually the end decision makers, just like with US Bank, on many of these different issues? So that was our vision of an alignment and that power analysis that undergirded it. It's kind of a simple way to say it is the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? Pulling them together and trying to figure out how we build. So some other things that we did that were, I think, a little bit different was with a coalition, often you sort of say, okay, community organization, you turn your people out at this time at the Capitol, I'll turn my people out and we'll push together. But you don't really get under the hood within each other's organizations. In fact, sometimes it's like, hey, stay out of my organization. I'll get my 30 people there. Don't you worry about it, right? This was the opposite. This was, if we're going to be in a long-term relationship with each other, because we're going to take on the long-term decision makers in our community, then we also want to be in a place where we can really invest in each other being more strong, because Local 26 by itself, we realized early on, was just not going to be strong enough to do this. We needed powerful other partners that were growing. That was in our self-interest, is to have powerful partners. So to do that, we started to share staff. We created a structure that we called the mobile team. The mobile team was a set of researchers and organizers and communicators that had some specialized skills that none of our organizations could really pull off on our own. But by sharing them together, we really were able to start to operate at a much more sophisticated level. And we also did things like joint weeks of action, where sometimes they would just be a single date on the calendar, and everybody would try and do an action during that week on their own respective issues in their own respective places. And what we found is by doing it on the same time, even though the demands were different, sometimes the targets were different, it actually created a sense of momentum that was much bigger. And in the context of that momentum, each of us could get more from our separate lanes. One concrete example of that was target. So Local 26 had security officers that were in a non-union company at the time called G4S. And we were having a problem getting Target to work with us to become union on the security side. At the same time, Satul, which was a worker center, was doing a campaign around responsible contractors, and they were engaging a contractor by the name of Carlson that was primarily cleaning at Cub. They actually had a hunger strike at Cub to try and get Cub to create a responsible contractor policy with Carlson, and they had failed. They were not successful, just as Local 26 at that time was not successful around what we were trying to do with the security officers. And they realized that Carlson also cleaned Target stores. Then we also had a group called Take Action Minnesota that was pushing for ex-offenders to be able to get jobs and, you know, back into the workforce after incarceration. And one of the things that they were trying to get rid of was a movement around that was around the country at the time, ban the box, right? Trying to ban the box that people had to check on employment applications showing if you had a previous record. So they also were trying to figure out how to make a breakthrough, and Target was a part of the Chamber of Commerce that was blocking the moving of this ban the box bill at the state legislature. And they had blocked it for 5-10 years. So they weren't winning either. And then finally, the fourth organization was Isaiah, was organizing with some churches from the West African communities to the north of the city in a place called Brooklyn Park. And they were trying to get some good new jobs. And Target had just bought a huge campus and built it and promised to bring a bunch of jobs. But in fact, Target had just moved a bunch of downtown, primarily white office workers, out to the suburban location rather than hiring from the community. So we had four campaigns that all were fighting in their own lanes, and we were all losing. And so when we discovered that, and through research, right, and through this mobile team, we said, well, let's talk to Target together, right? Let's see what happens. So each of us had our separate issues, and we started to campaign separately, but all building towards more and more pressure on Target. We created a week of action where we said, okay, let's each do these actions during the same week. And as a result, we were able to make huge breakthroughs on each one of those different areas, right? And we actually, there was one moment when we were literally sitting in a library in Brooklyn Park where top executives of Target were sitting there across this cute little, small table that the kids usually sit at. And then we had rank and file members from each of our organizations across the table from them talking about the key issues that we were trying to address. Target changed its policy on ban the box. They got rid of it as Target, first in Minnesota, then nationally. And then within a few months, they got the Chamber of Commerce to go to neutral on the bill at the state legislature. And it was passed as law in all of Minnesota, which is what it is now. Satul was able to do incredible work to raise the standards of the cleaners in those big box stores. They want a responsible contractor policy from Target. that then ended up including later on Cub, which was great because that was where they'd lost the the previous battle. And now those members are actually a part of Local 26. And so we just had huge breakthroughs across the board. And that was for us what bargaining for the common good meant, this orientation, thinking about how can we use our traditional power as unions to think more broadly about what's happening in the community and pull other partners in, not just to support us. I mean, they may also do that, which is great, but fundamentally on their own constituencies, on their own organizational growth, how can we bring them together for a long-term alignment?
This is all very exciting. So right now we're talking at the end of 2023. I know that you're working to build towards a week of action in March, extending this idea of how to build alignment with other organizations and community groups and build towards more power. Can you share with us what you're expecting to see in Minnesota over the next few months?
Well, we are mostly exhausted because we've been in a lot of bargaining. You know, as a result of some of those concepts that I've talked about, we now have all 8,000 of our members have the expirations of their contracts sometime in the next 2 months. So we've got multiple different master contract tables that we're sort of at seemingly every day in bargaining right now. But it's very exciting. As always, our hope is that we can, at these separate bargaining tables, reach a fair contract and then we'll settle. Actually, just 2 days ago, the first of those contracts settled. It's a smaller group of workers called Block by Block, but they do some of the downtown safety ambassador work. And the demands for all of our tables are the same, which is we want to try and get as close to $25 as possible in pay. And we want to win a pension, which in Minnesota we haven't seen since the early 80s when the entire industry went to subcontracting. So the great news is we just won our first $25 an hour and a pension at Block by Block. So we hope to use that at the other bargaining tables. But of course, you always hope for the best and prepare for the worst. So if we are not able to reach a fair contract with these different contractors across security and janitorial and airport and retail, then we are prepared by March 2nd, if we don't have fair settlements in each of those contracts, to go on strike. So that's Local 26. At the same time, we have set up a table, again, in this alignment framework, over the last year and a half, talking with other unions that have expirations in and around the same time. So that includes the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers in Minneapolis, SPFE in St. Paul, a laborers union that represents park employees and city workers, the other two SEIU locals, 284, which represents public sector, like bus drivers and cafeteria workers in the public schools, and Healthcare Minnesota, Iowa, that represents nursing home workers. So each of these expirations are sort of already there on the calendar together in and around that March timeline. And then in addition to that, we have our set of close community allies over the years that have been a part of these alignments, including Inquilinos Unidos, which is an organization focused on renters, and Satul, the Worker Center, and others. So we're just really excited because by having, you know, we've set now a week of action, similar to what we've done before. And so folks are lining up the different actions that they could do that week. And so, you know, again, we hope for good settlements and be able to achieve what we're asking for. But that said, if not, there is the chance that multiple unions will be on strike at the same time as multiple direct actions with many of our community allies. And what's exciting to me, too, is that we're talking in terms of four big buckets that we want to see breakthroughs on. We actually had a huge gathering of 1,000 of the leaders of these different organizations all at the Mall of America. We wanted to go big, so we figured we'd go to the mall, which in Minnesota, you know, it's kind of the biggest spot we got outside the Capitol or the Vikings Stadium. And so we said, we believe that the people making decisions in the Twin Cities are the same folks, even though we're in different sectors, right? And, you know, those folks in the Minnesota Business Partnership and the big Fortune 500 companies that made incredible profits over the last 3.5 years where our frontline members, who most of whom were essential workers, were out there getting sick and dying at Local 26. We had 6 members pass away in the early stages of the pandemic. So, you know, those same decision makers that were making incredible profits are the ones that need to make some decisions so that our schools can get back on track, so that our environment can be protected in the future, and so that workers can have good wages, and so that we can have good schools. So this is just, for us, it's we have the same set of people that we want to engage in the long run, and those are the four buckets: good jobs, good housing, green future, and good schools. And although we have many different organizations in this formation that kicked that off on October 7th, all of them have demands around those different areas that we're either bringing to the table in bargaining or that we are moving through policy. So for example, in the green future bucket, Local 26 has a demand over the expansion of a green cleaning program where buildings can lower their carbon emissions by as much as 5% by listening to the actual janitors who are doing the cleaning and recycling and training folks to have more skills, but also making adjustments based on their wisdom, right? Not just at the policy level, but at the frontline worker level. So the investment in that training fund is one of the demands at our bargaining table that will have an impact on ecological issues. The teachers are making demands around getting bus cards from the district so that the teachers can come to school on the bus and reduce the number of cars that they're bringing. So, you know, different demands at the bargaining table traditionally, but then also policy demands. One of the key ones is in Minneapolis, something called the People's Climate Equity Fund. That would be a new line of dedicated funding that would go specifically towards communities of color and getting homes refitted so that the, you know, carbon emissions is significantly less, the use of energy is less. And at the same time, training folks from those same communities of color, many of the folks, places where our members come from is Local 26, in those jobs, in those green, good union jobs. So those are just some of the examples of what are coming to a head. But, you know, we all hope we can get these things achieved before then. But if not, then it will be a hot time in the streets in the middle of March in Minneapolis.
That's exciting and first time I've heard of a hot time in March in Minneapolis, but that is something we're really excited about. And your story is incredible because you really show how starting out small in just this, what we call base building model of one-to-one relationships can set the groundwork to employ all these other kinds of strategies. I know that you in Minnesota have also been winning major gains in the policy arena over the last couple of years, and it sounds like you're poised to win some more. I wanted to return to that first question I asked you about when you came into the union and the labor movement was so weak and it felt like maybe it was on its last gasp, and now we're in this incredible moment. Certainly you all in Minnesota, but around the country. I'm just curious your thoughts. How do you make sense of this moment for the labor movement?
You know, obviously there are structural things at play that have nothing to do with the strategies that we are implementing as a labor movement, right? There's a tight labor market right now, and that is giving workers an incredible leverage that was just not true in the early 80s and 90s. So we didn't create that situation, but obviously it is extremely important that we take advantage of it. Just as our opposition, you know, will take advantage of any moment that they feel like they have the ability to try and make cuts and roll back worker gains. So we have to be, I believe we have to take risks right now. Even the things that we've built in the Twin Cities over the last 20 years, you know, we're very proud of those. All the people who built those, you know, our initial president at Local 26, Javier Morillo, all of our leaders that have helped lead our union. We're so proud of what we've done. But even that, in my opinion, is too conservative. We must click to a different gear right now because the winds are with us. And so we have to take risks. We have to think big. We have to raise expectations, just like we did at Local 26 20 years ago when the conditions were difficult. We have to raise expectations even more now that the conditions are better. So that said, apart from the external conditions, internally, you know, I'm very heartened by a labor movement that seems much more impatient. It seems much more ready to take those risks. You know, we're learning some of the tools that the, you know, folks used in the past may not be as effective. We have new tools. You know, we need to be experimenting and seeing what works. You know, we know at Local 26, we've done many experiments that haven't worked. But because we've done a whole lot of experiments, the ones that have worked have been able to ratchet us forward. So I think we have to have that kind of mentality. I also love to see how much different experiments grow off each other, right? The incredible steps that the UAW has taken, you know, building on some of the steps forward that the Teamsters have done, like with each of these risks, you know, people are watching each other, right? Our members are talking about what's going on over there. In the Twin Cities, the nurses recently, about a year ago, went out on strike. The teachers, MFT, that's a part of this escalation towards March, they a year and a half ago went out on strike. You know, for a whole decade, Local 26 was almost the only union in the Twin Cities that was going out on strike. And now to have these other groups of workers that are frankly much more recognized in the public eye, like as a janitors and security officers union, half of our battle is just to be seen. Whereas these other groups of workers also taking a stand, there's just a beautiful reinforcement, I think, that's happening. So I think we have an incredible moment, and I just would push our team every morning, like, how can we be more bold, more ambitious? This is an incredible moment, and we won't get a lot of these. And so how do we make the most of it so that our members can have better lives and we can have a long-term voice of power in this country?
So it's so exciting to hear about all the work, Greg. I really admire what you've done, and I'm so excited for the Minnesota labor movement and the example you set for the rest of us. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks so much, Stephanie. And for any of you who want to come out in Minnesota in the middle of the winter, I know it's not generally talked about in glowing terms, but we'd love to have you out here. And if we're not able to settle good contracts by then, as I say, it could be fun.
The leadership of Local 26 saw that they needed a long-term strategy to win their demands. They spent the last 15 years building their base, organizing with members to deepen their commitment and connection to the union. Crucially, they formed alignments with other unions and community organizations because they knew that many of their demands could not be won without greater power. They needed a bigger we as the base. That work paid off. It allowed the union to win more at the bargaining table and to lay the groundwork for a huge mobilization in the spring of 2024.
Right now, SEIU Local 26, along with 9 labor and community partners, are gearing up for a huge week of action starting next week, March 2nd through the 9th. This is very exciting. It's unlike anything I've ever seen in my life of labor organizing. Up to 30,000 workers are prepared to strike. And you can help by donating to their strike fund. We will put a link in the show notes.
Our book, Practical Radicals, ends with a section devoted to 36 tools intended to help organizers and grassroots groups develop strategy. And in each episode, we'll be looking at one or two. Today, we're highlighting 2 tools. The first is Tool 17, a tabletop exercise. This is a tool that was developed in the military where generals and other military officers would simulate what would happen in the heat of battle. What would they do? What would their opponents do? How would troops and other forces move on the battlefield? We've adapted this methodology, which we think is incredibly useful, and in the tool, we highlight the scenario of a worker upsurge. You can adapt the tool to many, many circumstances where there are 2 or more sides locked in a struggle with each other, and it helps really clarify what your options are and how your opponents and other potential allies might respond as well. In this particular case, we have groups play the role of employers, local politicians, state politicians, unions, and more to see how a local strike might build power, spread, and win.
We also encourage you to explore Tool 13, which is a way to learn more about bargaining for the common good, the framework that guides the work we have seen in Minnesota. This tool can help groups find common demands and common targets.
Next time on Practical Radicals, we're going to dig deeper into base building by talking with Angeles Solis and Jose Lopez from Make the Road New York about how the base building model works in community organizing and how it was essential to win a historic victory few thought possible.
We proved that paternalistic band-aid solutions were unacceptable, and then we went on to secure the largest ever economic assistance package in the history of this country for excluded workers like undocumented workers.
Practical Radicals is made possible with support from the Roosevelt Institute. Harry Hanbury and Peter Kakoma produced the series, and Peter Kakoma is the series editor. Our theme music was composed by Christian Perez Yates and performed by Trio Gafas, with additional music by Peter Kakoma and Christian Perez Yates.
The song playing under the clip from Fundy, The Story of Ella Baker, was We Who Believe in Freedom, Ella's Song, written and performed by Bernice Johnson Reagan.
If you enjoy the show, please follow and rate the show on your podcast app and share it with friends. Join us next time for more practical and radical strategies to change the world.